All right, this is December 9th, 2015. Gabe Logan, Northern Michigan University, Director of Center of Upper Peninsula Studies, and I'm interviewing Mr. Rich Adams in regards to roughly life at K.I. Sawyer during the 1970s and his recollections of his time there. And so if we can go ahead and begin there, Rich. Mr. Adams, if you would, please state your name and spell it and your birth date for context.
My name is Richard Adams. That's R-I-C-H-A-R-D-A-D-A-M-S.
Just as it sounds.
Yeah, right. Not too hard.
And your birthday?
27 November 1938.
27 November. Oh, happy recent birthday. Yeah.
I just turned 77.
Congratulations. Rich, if you could, where are you from, sir?
I was born in Paducah, Kentucky, and my father took a job in Arizona when I was about 5 years old, so I was actually raised in Miami, Arizona.
Miami, Arizona? Yeah. Where's that? I haven't heard of that one.
Well, it's east of Phoenix, about maybe 50 miles. It's a small town.
Mm-hmm.
He was a diesel engineer, and they were just getting electric power with diesel engines, and so he moved out there to help them set up the electric generator.
What business was he in to do that? Was it with the military or?
No, he had learned how to work on diesel engines, and he worked on a lot of tugboats on the Mississippi River.
Oh,
and. I'm not sure how he was contacted for the job since I was only a little guy, but we ended up moving to Arizona. So I was raised in Arizona.
Did you have any siblings?
Yeah, I had six brothers and sisters. Two sisters, and the rest were brothers. I'm the oldest of all of them.
So let's see, 38, so it was still a territory.
Yeah. We did have cars.
Yeah. Okay, so you came of age in Arizona then?
Right.
And did you graduate from high school or you went to school?
I graduated. Actually, my dad quit that job and he took a job in Winslow, Arizona. He ran a 7-Up bottling company plant in Winslow, Arizona, and I graduated from that high school.
Huh. Did
in
you
1956.
Work in 56?
Yeah.
Did you work in the plant as well?
I did.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, I worked in a 7-Up bottling plant there during my summers, and I drank a lot of 7-Up, and I got a lot of cavities. Because back then, they didn't have diet soda. It was all sugar.
No, of course. You know? What did you do in the plant?
They didn't have cans in. They had just had bottle pop, and I was the one that fed the washing machine for the pop bottles that washed them out, and then they filled them, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a unique job.
Yeah.
You don't hear about that.
Yeah.
And then did you go into the military shortly?
I went into the military right from high school. Winslow was a small town, even smaller than Marquette. And so unless your father had a business there, there wasn't really any industry there. The railroad went through there. So back then they didn't have a lot of college loans and all that kind of thing. So. And I didn't really want to go to college anyway. I had enough studying and stuff. Mm-hmm. So most of the kids there, if their fathers didn't have a business, they joined the military. So I was in high school. I was in Air Force cadets, and that's how I got interested in the Air Force.
And then that's the branch of service you joined.
Yes.
The Air Force.
So
56. Okay.
Yeah.
So you got in there right at the start of the Cold War. Congratulations.
Yeah, right.
Where did you go from Arizona in 56?
In 1956, I joined the service and I went to a place called Parks Air Force Base near San Francisco for my basic training, which I'm sure it doesn't exist anymore. Hmm. And They interviewed me in the Air Force for what kind of jobs I qualified for, and I was able to get be an air traffic controller. So I went to Keesler Air Force Base for 6 months training in their Air Force school at Keesler Air Force Base for controllers.
Where was Keesler?
Biloxi, Mississippi.
Biloxi, okay. Yeah. Okay. And then you mentioned you served in Vietnam. Can you tell us a little about when you went over there? And
in 1968, I left Tinker Air Force Base.
Oklahoma City.
Oklahoma City. And I was assigned Da Nang, Vietnam, as an air traffic controller. I went to Da Nang, and I believe it was October of 68. And I was assigned as a crew chief controller in Da Nang Tower, which at that time was the busiest airport in the world. We had a takeoff and landing every 30 seconds on parallel runways, 24 hours a day, with all different kinds of traffic, from airliners to the slowest plane, porter type that CIA used. So we had a lot of mixed traffic there, so it was quite a challenge to be able to do that job at Da Nang. Wow. We were also surrounded by the enemy, so the only thing that kept them off the base, and every once in a while they came on the base,
this would be the Viet Cong.
Viet Cong NVAs, was a perimeter of Marines around the base. And every once in a while they come, what they call, come through the wire, and they would blow up some planes. And we had M-16s in the tower, and there was cases where we had to shoot from the catwalks because they were trying to blow the tower up, of course. And we never turned the rotating beacon on because they'd use that beacon as a target for their rockets.
Huh.
And I called in a lot of, we had Puff the Magic Dragon that circled at night. It was an AC-47. Because we were attacked just about every night. And when a rocket would go off, I could see it from the tower, and I would call in the fighters and Puff the Magic Dragon to pepper that spot with bombs and bullets and stuff like that. But the Viet Cong would usually set the rocket off and then they'd run. Uh-huh. So they weren't there.
And they knew what was coming.
Yeah, they knew what was coming next.
My gosh, did you feel kind of like a sitting duck up there?
Well, they said our rotating beacon was on top of the tower. They said, never turn that on. Because they could tell right where to shoot. But they weren't real accurate with their rockets. They would, every once in a while, they'd hit something they tried to. Like, they hit a barracks once and killed like 40 people in the barracks. So the rocket went right through the roof, and then it blew up inside with shrapnel all over the place. So, but usually they hit all over the place, and you could always tell when they're going to hit because there was a German Red Cross ship in Da Nang Bay, and the Viet Cong would notify the ship to back up out of the harbor because the Red Cross ship treated anybody, and that was their only hospital when they were wounded. So they took Viet Cong and treated them also, so they didn't want that ship sunk. So when that ship started backing up out of the harbor, you know you're going to get hit that night.
Huh. So, good Lord. I don't know much about air traffic control, obviously, but so without the radar, the signal, then would you have to visually, are you visually making landings? And
well, we visually control the traffic unless the weather was below 3 mile visibility and 1,000 foot ceiling. And then most of the planes, in fact, all the planes came in under radar control because it was called IFR, instrument flight rules. So, but because there was so much traffic there, we couldn't use standard separation. And that was one of the things that made it hard, because you had to use your own skill in how to get all this traffic in and out of there. And it was, you know, where normally you got 3 miles behind planes and all that. Well, if you had a slow-moving plane, there's times when I'd have the slow-moving plane touch down on one end of the runway, and I'd have the fighter touch down on the approach end. They're both sitting down at the same time. I just didn't have enough pavement and time to get all the traffic in.
And then that's because it was so busy.
So busy, yeah.
The busiest in
the world at that time, yeah.
Okay. Wow. So then you came to, so that's 68. And how long were you in Vietnam then, through 70?
Yeah, I came October 70. I came to KSR. That was after my month's leave and all that. So I put a bit over a year in Vietnam. Yeah.
Okay, so you came from the equator to the northern polar regions.
Yeah, in October, yeah.
What was that like when you arrived here at KI? What was your job?
Well, I worked as a crew chief at KSR Control Tower from 1970, and then I was promoted to chief controller for about the last year I was in the service. But I still went up in the tower and controlled traffic, even though it was kind of an office job. So it was quite interesting here. But I had to get back in the books when I got here because I couldn't control the traffic like I did at Da Nang, since it was slower here.
Oh.
So.
And you had your radar.
Yeah. They took me off the mic and said, you got to spend a couple days and get back in the rigs and... you can't control these B-52s like you did those fighters.
So you arrived here then, you're working in the tower. Did you live in KI on base? Or
yes, I lived on Skybolt Street, I believe it was. Yeah, Skybolt Street, right on base, yeah.
Okay. What was life like moving here in October 1970 in terms of you're here in the fall? And do you remember your first winter here?
Well, first off, I remember we came in the back gate at K.I. Sawyer, and if you ever come K.I. Sawyer from US 2 and take that road into the back gate, you wonder if you're ever going to get to an air base because it's all woods and all. And so I was talking to my wife, and she's from Michigan, so she knew about the base here. And I said, are you sure there's a base at the end of this road? It seems like nothing but woods here. And so we finally got here, and I spent the first night in a transit trailer. They had a transit trailer till you got a house and all. And it was right near the flight line. And that night, in the middle of the night, they had an exercise, and they started up all the aircraft. And the trailer was right up near the flight line, and the whole trailer started rocking. And we had three small kids at that time, and they all came running into our bedroom and saying, "What's going on? What's going on?" You know. So that was kind of our introduction to K.I. Sawyer that first night when they had the exercise.
How many planes would K.I. Sawyer have, and what type of planes would they have?
Well, when I was there in the 70s, they had B-52s. And KC-135s, tankers, and I believe it was interceptors, F-101s, and T-33s. The T-33s were the target for the 101s when they went out. They practiced their runs on the T-33s.
Hmm.
So, of course, during time I was there, the aircraft changed. I believe they upgraded to 102s and then 106s. I think they had 106s when I left there.
Huh.
So
when you're there at KI, obviously the snow was probably something that you didn't have to deal with.
The first winter there was quite awakening to me because they had some kind of record snowfall that year. And where we lived on base, the snow would drift up against our house. And of course, all the kids thought we were their luckiest house there because we had most of the snow and they could play in it. But for me, so there were times when I had to dig my way out of the house because I couldn't open the door because the snowbank, the snow had drifted so much up against the house. But that didn't keep me from work. If I couldn't get to work, they would send the snow cat that box thing on tracks up to get me at my house and take me to work, but usually they wouldn't take me back home just to work.
And then when you were at KI, what would your day, you said you initially were with air traffic control, but you had to relearn it for KI standards.
Right.
So what would be a typical day there at the base?
Well, for me, I worked what they call a shift swing, afternoon, morning, mid. That means one day I worked like the evening shift, and then the next day I'd come in at noon and work till, I guess, around 5 when the evening shift would come on. And then the next day I'd work mornings, which would be like 6 till noon, and then I'd come in that very night and work from midnight till 6 in the morning when the morning crew would come, and then you have one day off. So to get 2 days off, you'd have to stay up after your mid-shift. Except for your leave, and you only had one day off, so you didn't have a lot of time to think about what you're going to do, you know.
So planes were coming in then 24/7 for the most part?
Nights it was slower. And of course, when the weather was bad, it was slower too, because the pilots couldn't get up in the air and practice their touch and goes and all that, because they were under IFR rules, you know. But when the weather was nice, and sometime I'd have to think when I looked out and saw the sun shining and blue sky, uh-oh, I'm going to have to really work today, because they would all take off and practice, you know, their touch and go landings and everything they had to practice, where they couldn't practice all that during the weather. Mm. But the planes came and went regardless of the weather. If the weather was over a half a mile and the ceiling was over 200 feet and the runway was 01 where they could use precision approach, then they kept flying. Hmm. But the B-52s, since they could go so far and carry so much fuel, they would call in and see what the weather was, and if it was anywhere near being bad, they would say, we're going to our alternate, which might be Sacramento, California, or somewhere like that. You can bet it was somewhere nice, because when I used to see them loading the planes, they was putting their golf clubs on, and they'd have tennis rackets and all that, and I used to wonder, in the middle of winter, what the heck are these guys doing putting their golf clubs and tennis rackets on? And then I found out they were hoping for bad weather so they could head somewhere, some sack base that was in a nice weather, and they could get there and go in crew rest and play a little golf and tennis and stuff in January and February. So that was kind of nice. And the fighters had the same thing. They had, I think as they called it, William Tell. And they would go to Florida, a section of them would go to Florida, and in the middle of winter, and practice, there'd be several bases, squadrons go there, and they would practice their bombing runs and strafing, and it was a contest as to which squadron could be the best. But they left to go there, because to go to Florida out of K.I. Sawyer in January was really nice, so they enjoyed going down there.
What was the population approximately of K.I.? Was it? I've heard that it was the largest town in the Upper Peninsula at that point.
Yeah, thinking back, I think it was around 6,000, but don't quote me on that. It was, they had their own, you know, store, filling station, and everything a small town would have, they had there, post office, and so it was like a little small town, yes.
Okay. Were people there from all over the United States then, for the most
yes,
part?
Yes, they were all from all over. Most people from the South had a little problem at first there, because they were used to warm weather, you know, and they hadn't drove in in icy roads. They don't realize when you turn your wheel, sometime the car don't turn, it just keeps going straight. And when you come up to a stop sign, you hit the brakes, well, you know, the car keeps rolling.
Right on going.
Keeps going, yeah.
Did the did Sawyer have a reputation as opposed to some of the other? I'm sure every Air Force base had its own personality, but how was Sawyer regarded compared to the other Air Force bases around that you were familiar with or heard about?
Well, I think Sawyer created a lot. There's a lot of civilian jobs on KI Sawyer, and except for complaints by the young people that all the airmen dated the pretty girls in town, I don't think there was a lot of complaints. There was one time that somehow they started complaining about them, and back then they had a paymaster, and you were actually paid in dollar bills.
No.
So the base commander said, I want everybody paid in $2 bills so the town can see how much money is put into town. Because $2 bills weren't common.
Yeah.
So the people could see how much Sawyer contributes to the economy. But mostly, I don't think it was a big problem. In fact, the businesses actually liked K.I. Sawyer when the mines were having problems with laying people off and shutting down. And the auto dealers courted the airmen and people from the base because even though they might not have made a lot, they had a steady paycheck every 2 weeks. So they would have new car shows out by the base exchange trying to get airmen to buy new cars and stuff.
Yeah, I see.
Because they had a steady income.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well.
You know?
Smart business.
Yeah.
So we have Air Force, this... the bombers, what was their role, and please educate me on this, what were the roles of the B-52s? What were they doing there? Was it...
Well, SAC's idea was peace
Strategic
through
Air
strength.
Force Command.
Strategic
okay.
Air Command was peace through strength.
Hmm.
So they would load the bombers up, and they would send them up over the North Pole in orbit. They would be gone for 23 hours... and they would send tankers with them to refuel them.
In air?
In the air. They would be in the air 23 hours. That's their flight plan, 23 hours. And each one of the bombers, of course, had a target in case they get the right signal to go. And that was the idea, to let Russia know that we were ready if they tried anything. And also we had the interceptors that monitored our northern border that would take off to for any incoming aircraft that weren't known as friendly. They would go check them, and they would scramble quite often for, say, an airliner that missed his what called identifying going through the aircraft defense area. They had a line, and you had to penetrate this area at a certain time, and if you were off by I don't know how many minutes, because I wasn't into that, they would scramble a fighter on you to verify who was going through this what they call ADAS area, Air Defense Identification Zone. So they scrambled quite often out of KI Sawyer to just check. As far as I know, they didn't see any enemies there. I hope not, but it's usually a plane that was missing its flight plan time.
Uh-huh.
Or, you know, was off course a bit or something like that.
Hmm. Were the B-52s, were they carrying nukes or?
Yes.
They were.
As everybody knows, I'm sure they know, they had nuclear stored at KI Sawyer.
I know, actually I don't. Where were those stored?
Where that mill that makes 2x4s.
Okay.
In that area right there was where they were stored. They had tunnels, I guess, in the ground, and when they moved these nukes, you'd always know because they had guards and not tanks, but these weapons carriers with machine guns, you know, protecting them and stuff.
Was it above ground, or were they moved above ground? Or
they were moved above ground. Yeah, when they moved them to put them on the bombers, yeah, they were above ground. But okay. I think they were stored inside. I've never been there, but I think there's tunnels inside there where they stored the bombs.
Huh. Were those rotated out? were they sent?
Well, I wasn't into that kind of thing, but I think they were rotated.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, I would see the, you couldn't get anywhere near them, of course, when they were moving them back and forth. So they must have rotated them to work on them or update them or something,
sure.
You know.
Were there any mishaps or, that you heard of? Or?
Nope. I didn't.
Well, that's good.
I didn't hear of any. I know they had some mishaps where planes crash with those aboard and stuff like that, but I don't think they would arm them where they'd go off until, unless they were going toward their target, of course. Mm-hmm. I don't know that much about the bombs.
As far as the winter and the landing and the takeoffs, was the airport, were there ever any accidents in terms weather-related, or did the Air Force always manage to do business as usual?
Well, they wanted to do business as usual because if K.I. Sawyer was ever taken off alert status, the wing commander could probably lose his job.
Oh.
So, you know, he didn't want to call in to where the headquarters were for all of SAC and say, K.I. Sawyer is down, we can't take us off alert status. So they had a lot of snow removal equipment, and it was pretty well going 24 hours a day.
Hmm.
Because they could take off in any weather, but of course they couldn't land in any weather. So they didn't want to be taken off of alert status.
I see.
During the storms, the snow plows were out there all the time. And then what we'd do is we would, until the plane wanted to land, we'd let the snow equipment stay on the runway. And we had, there was a guy called Snowman One. He was in charge of all the equipment. And from the tower, we would contact him and tell him. And then he would take care of course, as many pieces of equipment on the runway. He'd take care of the equipment on the runway, getting it on and off and like that. And we used to have one guy, he was Finnish. And if we said, Snowman One, tower, get the equipment off right away, we got an emergency coming in. Well, he'd get all up excited, and he would talk in Finnish. Well, all the snowplow drivers knew, if he starts talking in Finnish, get the heck off the runway, because there's something going to happen here, you know. So he'd get excited and start talking in Finnish.
That's a little different.
Yeah.
So you were there up until 1976.
Yeah, I retired in 76. I had orders for Korea, and I had about 23 years in then, and my wife said, I've had enough of this, you being gone. And we had three teenage boys by then, which, you know, they need a man around. And so she said, you better get out. I was going to go to Korea because I could have left my wife on base, and she could have stayed right there in the house till I got back, and then I could put another term in at K.I. Sawyer. And maybe make 30 years and retire that in such a way that maybe I don't have to get another job or anything, you know,
mm-hmm.
unless I wanted to. But she said, I've had enough of you being gone, so it was either get out or look for another wife, maybe. And I didn't want to do that,
no.
So...
Why did you all decide, did you retire to the Upper Peninsula then? Was this your final
place? Yeah, when I was ready to get out of the service, I started looking for work because with my retirement pay, of course, at 50%, I didn't make enough to take care of three boys and a wife and have a home and a car and all that. So I started looking for work, and I started with the Department of Corrections, and they like military people because they're kind of military their own self at that time. You know, you have, in fact, they were more military than the military, I thought, when I went to work for them, because they had, you know, when the captain came in, you had to stand at attention, and they inspected your uniform before you went on post duty, and so it was kind of a military organization. So they liked people who'd been in the military because they were used to that kind of thing.
Was this Marquette?
Marquette Branch Prison, yeah.
I just interviewed a gentleman who was a captain there for 30 years. He lived, I can't remember his name right now. I just interviewed him, so I'm thinking you probably knew him.
Well, I could have knew him, but actually working in a prison wasn't my cup of tea. So I went to work for CCI a few years after I worked at the prison. I got a job at CCI. And when I went for the interview there, I walked into the fellow that's going to interview me at CCI, and I had my uniform on because I'd left work to go straight there. And his eyes got really big when I walked in there, and he said, "Are you from the DNR? Are you a conservation officer?" And I guess our uniform looked kind of like conservation officer uniform. And I said, "No." He said, "Oh." He said, I got a warning this weekend about catching a fish that was illegal." And I thought he was coming back to give me a ticket or something. He said, "I'm so relieved that you're not the conservation officer come to give me a ticket. You got a job." So I went to work for CCI, and I worked for them till 1981, when they had the big layoff and a lot of mines around here closed.
When you say Cleveland Cliffs, was it the Palmer mine?
Yeah, Empire Mines where I worked.
Empire Mine.
Yeah.
What was your job there?
Was a grinding mill attendant.
What did that entail?
Well, I took care of the mill, the big mill that makes little rocks out of big rocks. So if it stopped, I had to figure out what the problem was and get it going again. So. I liked working there, but in 1981 they closed Republic Mine, Mather B Mine, Eagle Improvement Plant. So there was like 2,500 men around here without good jobs. So,
what caused the mine closures?
Brazilian iron ore.
Oh.
At least that's what the mining journal said. They could ship iron ore from Brazil all the way up here cheaper than we could produce it out here at the Empire Mine. But of course, they didn't have any environmental rules. And probably their workers came to work on a bicycle, you know, and they maybe made $1 an hour or something. Americans aren't going to do that.
No.
So that's kind of, you know. And of course, the steel plants were buying iron ore wherever they could get it cheapest. They didn't care where it came from. So that's what supposedly I lost my job, and even today they're running into that problem because iron ore is, you know, not the foreign countries can make it a lot cheaper than we can do here on the Marquette Range, so they're kind of in problems even today with that.
Yeah, that's good. Dave, your son works at the mines,
Dave,
right? And I've been seeing that all the signs up everywhere, and
there's
certainly a
presence. There's still not a contract settled, and
still
I don't know. There's rumors that the Empire might go down next summer. I don't work there anymore, so I can't say that's true or not true. Hmm. But my son has about 24 years in there, and of course, you know, he's worried about it too.
I think all of us are worried about that.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay, so while you worked there, just since you have this background that I didn't know about in air traffic control, before we leave this period, one of President Reagan's more infamous moves was when the air traffic control folks on strike, and he broke the union and fired them all. Do you have any thoughts on that one?
At the time, I was working for, when I got laid off from the mine, I went to work for Simmons Airline as aircraft dispatcher, because I kind of fell back on my air traffic control experience, and that's how I got this job. And so I had to go to New York and take a test for being licensed And
what year was this about? Was it prior to the 80s? Or
84, I went to work for Simmons Airlines.
Okay, so it's right around the same time. Okay.
In 1984, I went to work for Simmons Airlines. And
so you went to New York to take the test.
Simmons Airlines was a small airline with just very few planes, and it was under Federal Orders 135, which... they had a flight followers, but not licensed dispatchers. And as the airline got bigger, they had to go under Federal Rules 121, which meant you needed a licensed dispatcher. That's kind of called the pilot on the ground. And we look at the route of flight and all to make sure the plane can go safely. We look at the weather conditions, the nav aid conditions, what kind of shape the airplane is in. Does he have to go in thunderstorms? If so, he must have radar. If the weather's good, he don't need radar, things like that. We're kind of a safety factor for the airlines. And although people don't know, for each flight, an aircraft dispatcher releases that flight. And the dispatcher's saying, I believe this plane can fly safely between point A and point B. And it's a partnership between the dispatcher and the pilot. Of course, the pilot, he's up in the airplane, so he's got the main, but he cannot leave the ground till he gets a flight release from the aircraft dispatcher.
I see.
Yeah.
And so
I went to work as a flight follower, and then when it came 121, I went to a place in Long Island, New York City. It was taught by an ex-pilot that had a medical condition, so he went into this teaching for the test to take. And I won't say they taught you the test, but you had 3 days of study, I'd say, on what's kind of on the test, not the questions, but the subject matter. And of course, I since I'd been in air traffic control for almost 23 years, I had no problem with that. And so once you pass the written, then you go back to your home base, so to speak. If you've passed the written, then you come back and take a practical. And the practical test is they give you a flight that you have to dispatch between the conditions, and they give you all the weather and everything. Of course, it's not a real plane. Mm-hmm. It's just on paper. And you have to figure out, can this plane do all this with what the weather is? You have the departure weather, you have the arrival weather, you have weather en route and upper winds. And so you have to, on paper, see if this flight could make it or not. And my flight was supposed to go, I think, from Philadelphia to New York City. And it turned out that the destination airport, the runway condition versus the wind condition, the plane could not land there because each plane has a certain criteria as to crosswinds and condition of the runway. So I had to divert him to another spot. I don't remember where, but the instructor said, you're the first guy ever diverted that plane. He said, how come you diverted it? And I told him why. But the reason that I knew this was, in Simmons Airlines, we worked all winter long with the north central area, and we dealt with runway conditions, crosswind factors, and all that. So I was quite up to date in that kind of thing. Even though I wasn't a dispatcher, as a flight follower, Simmons Airlines still required us to look at each flight to see if the plane could make it all right. So we were dealing with that every day.
I see. So did that help you get a? Did you get a job, or was that part of the?
I had the job. I had to get a dispatch license. So to do it, and they had to hire dispatchers from. Well, they came from all over the country when the federal government said Simmons had to be a 121 operation.
Were the flight attendants, the dispatchers and the followers, how did they regard Reagan's busting the union?
Well, actually, a lot of the air traffic controllers that were fired, some of them came to work for Sawyer or for Simmons as dispatchers, and I got to talk to some of them. And they were told by their union, don't worry about a thing. He can't fire us all. There's no way he can fire every air traffic controller. But what they did is they did fire all the air traffic controllers. Of course, this made their traffic slow down. But what they did is they took military controllers from each base and they sent them to work the civilian traffic. Now here at Sawyer, a lot of them went to, I think, Pittsburgh. They took two or, they couldn't take them all, of course, because you had to keep the base going, but they would take, you know, two or three from this base, two or three from that base, and they'd send them to places where they'd fired the civilian controllers. And some of those controllers, actually, their discharge date came up, and they stayed right there and worked for the FAA.
No kidding.
For a lot more money, of course. You know, they stayed right in the place where they were and worked for the FAA.
Well, there's a little story that didn't get told a lot.
So. But the union told me, I worked with a lady that just got out of air traffic control school at Oklahoma City, where they have their FAA school there. And it's a hard school, you know. And she didn't really want to go on strike, but she said, you didn't have much choice. If the union said you're going to go on strike and not go to work, she said, I didn't really want to because I just finished all my schooling and just started my job. So I didn't want to, like, you know. But she said I didn't have any choice because if I had not have gone on strike and for some reason then settled, I would have been ostracized.
Sure.
You know, I would have been thought as a scab or whatever, you know. So she more or less had to go on strike with the rest of them, you know.
And then she lost her job.
She lost her job and she came to work for Simmons Airlines as a dispatcher, yeah.
Yeah, fascinating little sidetrack.
Yeah.
So before we leave that, I want to, what influenced you and your family to stay in the Upper Peninsula?
My wife... she was not too happy about staying here because she said she married a GI to get the heck out of here. She's from the Sioux area. And I met her when I was working for the Air Guard in Alpena, Michigan. Her father was a teacher there in Alpena, and I met her. She used to be a car hop at the root beer stand between her college time. And so all the guys used to go to the bar, I'd go to the root beer stand. Because I had a little interest at the root beer stand besides root beer. But anyway, she wanted to get the heck out of Michigan. And she was quite upset that I got K.I. Sawyer. And that was like, you know, you get what they call a dream sheet when you're in the military. And when you're leaving somewhere, you put down where you want to go. And usually they pick the last thing, seemed like. And the K.I. Sawyer happened to be the last thing. And the only reason I put that was I'd worked in Alpena, Michigan for the Air Guard, which was a National Guard base there in the summer. And I liked it there, so I didn't know what to put. So I put, she was upset though. I did put Florida and Arizona and places like that. But for some reason they sent me here.
I guess you could have put Ken Ross and it would have.
Yeah, I put Ken Ross.
The only one worse.
Yeah, that's right.
And so y'all have made a life up here?
Well, when I'm getting ready to retire, I sold my snow tires, anything had to do with snow. I sold it, and this was in October. So as I was going to go to Arizona, because the Air Force will move you when you retire anywhere you want to go, they'll give you one move anywhere. So I was going to go back to Arizona because I still had brothers and relatives back there, and she was all fine with that. But then I happened to get this job at the prison, and I thought, well, I got a job here. Maybe I'll just stay here, you know.
Buy all my stuff back.
I had to do that. I had to, you know, back then we actually changed tires. You remember you had your summer tire and your winter tires, and you had to. So I had to buy all these tires, but my wife was she was upset at me. So we moved here to Gwin, and I went to work at the prison, and I worked there a couple years till I went to the mine.
But, yeah, she's still kind of mad at me about that. I don't mention it much.
Yeah, you've made a nice life for her.
Yeah, that's kind of, you know, what, I've been married 50-some years, and she's been mad at me for 30.
She'll get over it, Rich.
Yeah, time will get it. Yeah, she'll get over it, yeah.
Well, now when you drive back through KI, I guess it was decommissioned in 95?
Yes, right? 95.
And, what do you see? What do you see?
I feel like crying.
Oh, really?
I mean, it was a jewel of the Upper Peninsula bases. It was nice here. I really liked it here. And now, as you know, the buildings are dilapidated. There's been a lot of trouble out there. You know, it's got a bad reputation. And I don't live there. I've talked to people that love it there, and I've talked to people that hate it there. But, I know Gwynn police spend most of their time out of KI Sawyer. Yeah.
Any ideas what could be done to revitalize it, from your opinion? Or,
well, you take, I understand Wart Smith is not like KI Sawyer. They've made a senior community out of it. And Kinchlow, they've... that's a prison now, where the barracks were. I guess they keep prisoners in that area. But here, they haven't done much. And, of course, you can buy a home really cheap out there, which would be a good deal, but it gets run down. A lot of places out there, if you go out there, some of them are really nice and others are really run down. So it's not been kept up, and... I don't know what can be done, but well, you take the electronic company from San Diego that was supposed to be out there in the Sage Center because it had no windows. Well, all they did is take advantage of all the government benefits to come here, and then they left. You know, they didn't stay here. So I don't know what can be done, but it's enough to make you cry because it... They had a nice library, movie theater, hospital, dental clinic, all that, and all that's just gone now.
It's gone, yeah. Yeah, you know, it's... I saw an old soccer field out there.
Yeah.
And that's just something... That's,
yeah, they had lighted soccer fields.
Yeah, it's kind of unique to the Upper Peninsula. And
yeah.
Of course...
Bowling alley.
A bowling alley.
Only bowling alley we had around here, and... Now, I guess it's just an empty building. You know, they tore the lanes up, and so I don't... It's enough to make you cry for somebody that was stationed here.
Yeah.
You know, it's...
Saw it in its heyday.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to add, or thoughts on the Upper Peninsula, looking at it now for the past 30 years, 40 years?
Well, a lot of people... When I first got here, I thought I wouldn't like it here because I'd never lived in snow country before. But they had great recreational things out there. You could rent, you could borrow skis, you could borrow snowshoes. And so I learned to start getting out in the woods and doing things. And once you start doing some of the winter stuff, I liked it a lot better. Now, I had met guys that... not so much on the base, but dispatchers who would come up here, say, from Florida, and one guy left and went back somewhere, but his first winter here, he said it's too cold for the kids to get outside. Well, he had several young kids, and I said, well, you got to buy them snow suits and let them get out and play. Oh, no, it's too cold. Well, you can imagine if you had three or four little kids in your house all winter long, and you don't let them outside to play, it's going to drive you and your wife crazy, you know. So I learned to adjust to the situation, and I really liked it. I did a lot of backpacking, canoeing, kayaking, all that kind of stuff. And then in the winter, I cross-country skied a lot. I never did downhill ski, but I cross-country skied, and I... went snowshoeing, and KI Sawyer was great for all that because at that time there was nothing behind the base except Little Lake. There was no homes or nothing, and so you could go all the way from your house all the way out to Little Lake without seeing anything, and they were like two track roads. So you had no property. You had a lot of outdoor stuff you could do. So I would say for most people, if you get out and start doing it and get out of the house, you're going to like it a lot more here, especially in the winter, because it is long winters.
Yeah. Embrace the winter.
Yeah.
That was the advice I got when I moved here.
Yeah.
Embrace it. It sounds like that's what
you
did.
Yeah. That's about it. I enjoyed my time at K.I. Sawyer, and I would have put another tour in there, but I had this lady at home that kind of shied away from that, so had a lot of influence on me.
Yeah, they do that.
Yeah.
All right then, Rich. Well, thank you for your time.
Yeah.
And that concludes our interview.
Okay, I've enjoyed it.
Yes, sir. Okay, yeah. So,